scent and smoke and sweat of a casino are nauseating at 3 in the morning. James Bond suddenly knew that he was tired. He always acted on this knowledge. It helped him to avoid staleness and the sensual bluntness that breeds mistakes. He shifted himself unobtrusively away from the roulette he had been playing and went to stand for a moment at the brass rail which surrounded the top table in the salle privée. Le Chiffre was still playing and still, apparently, winning. In the shadow of his thick left arm there nestled a discreet stack of big yellow plaques worth 500,000 francs each. Bond watched the curious, impressive profile for a time, and then he shrugged his shoulders to lighten his thoughts and moved away. He imagined tomorrow's regular morning meeting of the casino committee.
Monsieur Le Chiffre made 2 million. He played his usual game. Miss Fairchild made 1 million in an hour and then left. She played with coolness. Monsieur le Vicomte de Villerain made 1,000,002 at roulette. He was lucky. Then the Englishman, Mr. Bond, increased his winnings to exactly 3 million over the 2 days. It seems that he is persevering and he has luck.
Merci, Monsieur Xavier.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Or something like that, thought Bond, as he pushed his way through the swing doors of the salle privée and nodded to the bored man in evening clothes, whose job it is to bar your entry and your exit with the electric foot switch, which can lock the doors at any hint of trouble. He breathed the sweet night air deeply and focused his senses and his wits. He wanted to know if anyone had searched his room since he had left it before dinner. He walked across the broad boulevard and through the gardens to the Hotel Splendide. He smiled at the concierge who gave him his key, number 45 on the first floor, and took the cable from her. It was from Jamaica, and read, Bond, Splendide, Royal Les Eaux, inferior Havana cigar production, all Cuban factories. 10 million, repeat 10 million. Stop. Hope this figure you require. Regards, Da Silva. This meant that 10 million francs was on the way to him. It was the reply to a request Bond had sent that afternoon through Paris to his headquarters in London, asking for more funds. Clements, the head of Bond's department, had spoken to M, who had smiled wryly and told the broker to fix it with the Treasury. Bond took his key and said good night and turned to the stairs, shaking his head at the liftman. Bond knew what an obliging danger signal a lift could be. He didn't expect anyone to be moving on the first floor, but he preferred to be prudent. Walking quietly up on the balls of his feet, he turned off the stairs into the corridor and walked softly to the door of his room. Bond knew exactly where the switch was, and it was with one flow of motion that he stood on the threshold with the door full open, the light on, and a gun in his hand. The safe, empty room sneered at him. Locking himself in, he bent down and inspected one of his own black hairs, which still lay undisturbed where he had left it before dinner, wedged into the drawer of the writing desk. Next, he examined a faint trace of talcum powder on the inner rim of the porcelain handle of the clothes cupboard. It appeared immaculate. He went into the bathroom, lifted the cover of the lavatory cistern, and verified the level of the water against a small scratch on the copper ballcock. Doing all this, inspecting these minute burglar alarms, did not make him feel foolish or self-conscious. He was a secret agent, and still alive thanks to his exact attention to the detail of his profession. Satisfied that his room had not been searched while he was at the casino, Bond undressed and took a cold shower. Then he lit his 70th cigarette of the day and sat down at the writing table with the thick wad of his stake money and winnings beside him, and entered some figures in a small notebook. Over the 2 days' play, he was up exactly 3 million francs. For a few moments, Bond sat motionless, gazing out of the window across the dark sea. Then he shoved the bundle of banknotes under the pillow of the ornate single bed, cleaned his teeth, turned out the lights, and climbed with relief between the harsh French sheets. His last action was to slip his right hand under the pillow until it rested under the butt of the .38 Colt Police Positive with the sawn barrel. Then he slept, and with the warmth and humour of his eyes extinguished, his features relapsed into a taciturn mask, ironical, brutal, and cold. 2 weeks before, this memorandum had gone from Station S of the Secret Service to M, who was then, and is today, head of this adjunct to the British Defence Ministries. To M, from head of S. Subject: a project for the destruction of Monsieur Le Chiffre, alias the Number, Herr Nummer, Herr Ziffer, etc., one of the opposition's chief agents in France and undercover paymaster of the Syndicat des Ouvriers d'Alsace, the communist-controlled trade union in the heavy and transport industries of Alsace, and, as we know, an important fifth column in the event of war with Redland. We have been feeling for some time that Le Chiffre is getting into deep water. It seems that he is on the brink of a financial crisis. Certain straws in the wind were noticed by Agent 1860, some discreet sales of jewellery, the disposal of a villa at Antibes, and a general tendency to check the loose spending, which has always been a feature of his way of life. The further inquiries were made with the help of our friends of the 12e Bureau, with whom we have been working jointly on this case, and a curious story has come to light. In January 1946, Le Chiffre bought control of a chain of brothels, known as the Cordon Jaune, operating in Normandy and Brittany. He was foolish enough to employ for this purpose some 50 million francs of the monies entrusted to him by Leningrad Section 3 for the financing of SODA, the trade union mentioned above. Barely 3 months later, on the 13th of April, there was passed in France Law No. 46685, known popularly as La Loi Maître Richard, closing all houses of ill fame and forbidding the sale of pornographic books and films. This knocked the bottom out of his investment almost overnight. Suddenly, Le Chiffre was faced with a serious deficit in his union funds. Today, nothing remains of Le Chiffre's original investment, and any routine inquiry would reveal a deficit of around 50 million francs in the trade union funds, of which he is the treasurer and paymaster. It does not seem that the suspicions of Leningrad have been aroused yet, but, unfortunately for Le Chiffre, it is possible that at any rate Smersh is on the scent. Last week, a high-grade source of Station P reported that a senior official of this efficient organ of Soviet vengeance had left Warsaw for Strasbourg via the eastern sector of Berlin. If Le Chiffre knew that Smersh was on his tail, or that they had the smallest suspicion of him, he would have no alternative but to commit suicide or attempt to escape. But his present plan suggests that while he is certainly desperate, he does not yet realize that his life may be at stake. It is these rather spectacular plans of his that have suggested to us a counter-operation which, though risky and unconventional, we submit at the end of this memorandum with confidence. In brief, Le Chiffre plans, we believe, to follow the example of most other desperate till robbers and make good the deficit in his accounts by gambling. We know that he has taken a small villa in the neighbourhood of Royal-les-Eaux, just north of Dieppe, for a week from a fortnight tomorrow. It is here that Le Chiffre will, we are confident, endeavour on or after the 15th of June to make a profit at Baccarat of 50 million francs on a working capital of 25 million, and, incidentally, save his life. A proposed counter-operation. It will be greatly in the interests of this country and of the other nations of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that this powerful Soviet agent should be ridiculed and destroyed, that his communist trade union should be bankrupted and brought into disrepute, and that this potential fifth column, with a strength of 50,000, capable in time of war of controlling a wide sector of France's northern frontier, should lose faith and cohesion. All this would result if Le Chiffre could be defeated at the tables. N.B. Assassination is pointless. Leningrad would quickly cover up his defalcations and make him into a martyr. We therefore recommend that the finest gambler available to the service should be given the necessary funds and endeavour to out-gamble this man. Signed, S. Head of S, the section of the Secret Service concerned with the Soviet Union, was so keen on his plan for the destruction of Le Chiffre that he took the memorandum himself and went up to the top floor of the gloomy building overlooking Regent's Park. He walked belligerently up to M's chief of staff.
"Now look here, Bill, I want to sell something to the chief. Is this a good moment?"
"What do you think, Penny?" The chief of staff turned to M's private secretary, who shared the room with him. "Miss Moneypenny would have been desirable, but for eyes which were cool and direct and quizzical." "Should be all right. He won a bit of a victory, the FO, this morning, and he's not got anyone for the next half an hour." She smiled encouragingly at head of S. The chief of staff crossed his office, docket in hand, and went through the double doors leading into M's room. In a moment he came out, and over the entrance a small blue light burned the warning that M was not to be disturbed. James Bond's interview with M had been short.
"What about it, Bond?"
Bond looked across the desk into the shrewd, clear eyes.
"It's very kind of you, sir. I'd like to do it. But I can't promise to win. The odds at Baccarat are the best after 30 et 40, but I might get a bad run against me and get cleaned out. Play's going to be pretty high. Opening will go up to 500,000, I should think."
Bond was stopped by the cold eyes. M knew all this already. That was his job, knowing the odds at everything, and knowing men, his own and the opposition's. Bond wished he had kept quiet about his misgivings.
"He can have a bad run too," said M. "You'll have plenty of capital, up to 25 million, the same as him."
He smiled.
"Go over a few days before the big game starts and get your hand in. I'm going to ask the deuxième to stand by. I'll try to persuade them to send Matisse. You seem to get on well with him in Monte Carlo on that other casino job. And I'm going to tell Washington.
Anything else?" Bond shook his head.
"I'd certainly like to have Matisse, sir."
"Well, we'll see. Try and bring it off. We're going to look pretty foolish if you don't.
And watch out. This sounds an amusing job, but I don't think it's going to be. Well, best of luck."
"Thank you, sir,"
said Bond, and went to the door.
"Just a minute."
Bond turned.
"I think I'll keep you covered, Bond. Two heads are better than one. They'll get in touch with you at Royale. You needn't worry. It'll be someone good."
Bond would have preferred to work alone, but one didn't argue with M. He left the room, hoping that the man they sent would be loyal to him, and neither stupid nor, worse still, ambitious. Two weeks after his interview with M, James Bond awoke in his room at the Hotel Splendide. He had arrived at Royal Les Eaux in time for luncheon 2 days before. There had been no attempt to contact him, and there had been no flicker of curiosity when he had signed the register, James Bond, Port Maria, Jamaica. M had expressed no interest in his cover.
"Once you start to make a set at Le Chiffre at the tables, you'll have had it," he said. "But wear a cover that will stick with the general public."
Bond knew Jamaica well, so he asked to be controlled from there and to pass as a Jamaican plantocrat whose father had made his pile in tobacco and sugar and whose son chose to play it away on the stock markets and in casinos. Bond had spent the last two afternoons and most of the nights at the casino playing complicated progression systems on the even chances at roulette. He had made some 3 million francs and had given his nerves and card sense a thorough workout. He had got the geography of the casino clear in his mind. Above all, he had been able to observe Le Chiffre at the tables and to note ruefully that he was a faultless and lucky gambler. Bond liked to make a good breakfast. After a cold shower, he looked out at the beautiful day and consumed half a pint of iced orange juice, 3 scrambled eggs and bacon, and a double portion of coffee, without sugar. He lit his first cigarette, a Balkan and Turkish mixture made for him by Morlands of Grosvenor Street, and watch the small waves lick the long seashore. He was lost in his thoughts when the telephone rang. It was the concierge announcing that a director of Radio Stangtor was waiting below with the wireless set he had ordered from Paris. "Of course," said Bond. "Send him up." This was the cover fixed by the deuxième bureau for their liaison man with Bond. Bond watched the door, hoping that it would be Matisse. When Matisse came in, a respectable businessman carrying a large square parcel by its leather handle, Bond smiled broadly and would have greeted him with warmth if Matisse had not frowned and held up his free hand after carefully closing the door.
"I have just arrived from Paris, monsieur, and here is the set you asked to have on approval."
Bond lifted his eyebrows at this mystery-making. Matisse paid no attention. He placed the set, which he had unwrapped, on the floor beside the unlit panel electric fire below the mantelpiece.
"It is just past 11," he said, "and I see that the Compagnon de la Chanson should now be on the medium wave from Rome. Let us see what the reception is like. It should be a fair test."
Matisse winked. He fiddled at the back of the set. Suddenly an appalling roar of static filled the small room.
"Oh, my dear monsieur, forgive me, please. Badly tuned."
And he again bent to the dials. After a few adjustments, the close harmony of the French came over the air, and Matisse walked up and clapped Bond very hard on the back and wrung his hand until Bond's fingers ached.
"My dear friend,"
Matisse was delighted,
"you are blown, blown, blown.
Up there," he pointed at the ceiling. "At this moment, either Monsieur Muntz or his alleged wife, allegedly bedridden with the grip, is deafened, absolutely deafened, and I hope in agony."
He grinned with pleasure at Bond's frown of disbelief. Then he became serious.
"How it has happened, I don't know. They must have been on to you for several days before you arrived. The opposition is here in real strength. This is an old-fashioned hotel. There are disused chimneys behind these electric fires, just here."
He pointed a few inches above the panel fire.
"Is suspended a very powerful radio pickup. The wires run up the chimney to behind the Muntz's electric fire, where there is an amplifier. Some of this we knew, because in France we are very clever. The rest we confirmed by unscrewing your electric fire a few hours before you got here."
Suspiciously, Bond walked over and examined the screws which secured the panel to the wall. Their grooves showed minute scratches.
"Now, to business," said Matisse, "before our good compagnon run out of breath. First of all, you will be pleased with your number two. She is very beautiful."
Bond frowned.
"Very beautiful indeed."
Satisfied with Bond's reaction, Matisse continued.
"She has black hair, blue eyes, and splendid protuberances. And she is a wireless expert, which, though sexually less interesting, makes her a perfect employee of Radio Stangtor and assistant to myself in my capacity as wireless salesman for this rich summer season down here."
Bond was not amused.
"What the hell do they want to send me a woman for?" he said bitterly. "Do they think this is a bloody picnic?"
"Calm yourself, my dear James. She's as cold as an icicle. Her cover's perfect, and I have arranged for her to team up with you quite smoothly. What is more natural than that you should pick up a pretty girl here as a Jamaican millionaire?"
He coughed respectfully. "What with your hot blood and all, you would look naked without one."
Bond grunted dubiously.
"Any other surprises?" he asked suspiciously.
"Nothing very much,"
answered Matisse. "Le Chiffre is installed in his villa. It's about 10 miles down the coast road. He has his two guards with him. They look pretty capable fellows."
"Anything else?" asked Bond.
"No. Come to the bar of the Hermitage before lunch. I'll fix the introduction. Ask her to dinner this evening. Then it will be natural for her to come into the casino with you. I'll be there too, but in the background. Oh, and there's an American called Leiter here, staying in the hotel. Felix Leiter. He is the CIA chap from Fontainebleau. London told me to tell you. He looks okay. May come in useful."
A torrent of Italian burst from the wireless set on the floor. Matisse switched it off, and they exchanged some phrases about the set and about how Bond should pay for it. Then, with effusive farewells and a final wink, Mattis bowed himself out. Bond sighed. Women were for recreation. On a job, they got in the way and fogged things up with sex and hurt feelings.
Bitch, said Bond.
Then, remembering the Munzes, he said, bitch again, more loudly, and walked out of the room. It was 12 o'clock when Bond left the Splendide, and the clock on the Marie was stumbling through its midday carillon. There was something splendid about the Negresco Baroque of the Casino Royale, a strong whiff of Victorian elegance and luxury. Against the background of this luminous and sparkling stage, Bond stood in the sunshine and felt his mission to be incongruous and remote. He shrugged away the momentary feeling of unease and walked round the back of his hotel and down the ramp to the garage. Before his rendezvous at the Hermitage, he decided to take his car down the coast road and have a quick look at Le Chiffre's villa. Bond's car was his only personal hobby. One of the last of the 4.5-litre Bentleys with the supercharger by Amherst Villas, he had bought it almost new in 1933 and had kept it in careful storage through the war. Bond drove it hard and well, and with an almost sensual pleasure. He eased the car out of the garage and up the ramp, and soon the loitering drumbeat of the 2-inch exhaust was echoing down the tree-lined boulevard, through the crowded main street of the little town, and off through the sand dunes to the south. An hour later, Bond walked into the Hermitage bar and chose a table near one of the broad windows. He ordered an Americano and examined the sprinkling of overdressed customers, mostly from Paris, he guessed, who sat talking with focus and vivacity, creating that theatrically clubbable atmosphere of l'heure de l'apéritif. Bond's eye was caught by the tall figure of Mattis on the pavement outside, his face turned in animation to a dark-haired girl in grey. Bond waited for them to come through the street door into the bar, but for appearance's sake, continued to stare out of the window at the passers-by.
"But surely it is Monsieur Bond!"
Mattis's voice behind him was full of surprised delight. Bond, appropriately flustered, rose to his feet.
"May I present my colleague, Mademoiselle Linde? My dear, this is a gentleman from Jamaica with whom I had the pleasure of doing business this morning."
Bond inclined himself with a reserved friendliness. "It would be a great pleasure." He addressed himself to the girl. "I am alone. Would you both care to join me?" He pulled out a chair, and while they sat down, he beckoned to a waiter and, despite Mattis's expostulations, insisted on ordering the drinks. Mattis and Bond exchanged cheerful talk about the fine weather. The girl was silent. She accepted one of Bond's cigarettes and then smoked it appreciatively, drawing the smoke deeply into her lungs with a little sigh and then exhaling it casually through her lips and nostrils. Her movements were economical and precise, with no trace of self-consciousness. Bond felt her presence strongly. While he and Mattis talked, he turned from time to time towards her, politely including her in the conversation, but adding up the impressions recorded by each glance. Her hair was very black, and she wore it cut square and low on the nape of the neck, framing her face to below the clear and beautiful line of her jaw. Although it was heavy and moved with the movements of her head, she did not constantly pat it back into place, but let it alone. Her eyes were wide apart and deep blue, and they gazed candidly back at Bond with a touch of ironical disinterest which, to his annoyance, he found he would like to shatter, roughly. Bond was excited by her beauty and intrigued by her composure. The prospect of working with her stimulated him. At the same time, he felt a vague disquiet. On an impulse, he touched wood. Mattis had noticed Bond's preoccupation. After a time, he rose.
"Oh, forgive me," he said to the girl. "I must arrange my rendezvous for dinner tonight. Are you sure you won't mind being left to your own devices this evening?"
Bond took the cue, and as Mattis crossed the room to the telephone booth beside the bar, he said, "Well, if you are going to be alone tonight, would you care to have dinner with me?" She smiled with the first hint of conspiracy she had shown. "I would like to very much," she said.
And then perhaps you would chaperone me to the casino, where Monsieur Matisse tells me you are very much at home. Perhaps I will bring you luck. With Matisse gone, her attitude towards him showed a sudden warmth. She seemed to acknowledge that they were a team, and as they discussed the time and place of their meeting, Bon realized that it would be quite easy, after all, to plan the details of his project with her. When Matisse came back to the table, Bon called for his bill. The girl's eyes followed him out onto the boulevard. Matisse moved his chair close to hers and said softly, "That is a very good friend of mine. I am glad you have met each other. I can already feel the ice floes on the two rivers breaking up." He smiled. "I don't think Bond has ever been melted. It will be a new experience for him." She did not answer him directly. "He's very good-looking, but there's something cold and ruthless in his..." The sentence was never finished. Suddenly, a few feet away, the entire plate-glass window shivered into confetti. The blast of a terrific explosion very near hit them so that they were rocked back in their chairs. There was an instant of silence. Some objects pattered down onto the pavement outside. Bottles slowly toppled off the shelves behind the bar. Then there were screams and a stampede for the door. "Stay there," said Matisse. He kicked back his chair and hurtled through the empty window frame onto the pavement.